coverage and some of the reasons the case had remained unsolved for so many years. Then he jumped to the arrests. The three suspects, he wrote, were indicted in late December of 1999, officially beginning an arduous and painful, not to mention lengthy, trip through the criminal justice system for everyone involved. Over 2.5 years into the process, we are in trial on the second suspect, and there is no end in sight when remaining trials and appeals, etc., are considered. He ended that paragraph with a blunt statement. No physical evidence has ever connected these defendants to the crime. 52, when he signed those affidavits, Mike Lynch kept fiercely fit by playing racquetball, tennis, softball, and basketball, and also by working out at a boxing gym. I used to play racquetball with him, one lawyer told me. I'd look back when he was about to serve, and he had this furious look on his face. We were friends, but for him, winning was everything. When he could get away, Lynch traveled widely to hunt fowl not found in Texas, and like fellow Arkansan Bill Clinton, he preferred to go by the short version of his given name. Nobody had ever called him Michael until he went to the first grade and the teacher asked him to spell his proper name, but he got it wrong, an embarrassment he has never forgotten. When he ran for the judgeship, he used the name everybody knew. On the bench and off, he's plain Mike. His career had traveled a restless path. A National Merit Scholar, after graduating from Amherst, he taught high school history and government in East Texas for a year, and then, to avoid military service, went to law school at UT Austin. By 1974, during the era longtime residents consider the city's salad days, he was interning for a group of left-leaning defense lawyers. When his apprenticeship ended, he teamed up with four friends in a criminal law firm and stayed there off and on for 9 years, until twitchiness hit him again, and he sold his share of the partnership and zoomed off on his motorcycle for a solo cross-country trip. Returning to the law after a couple of years, Lynch switched his field of advocacy, working for the state in the Attorney General's office and then in the Travis County DA's office, where he headed up a team investigating government corruption and white-collar crime. During those years, he became a colleague of Assistant DA Robert Smith, who would act as chief prosecutor in every capital case tried in his courtroom, including Springsteen and Scott. Lynch swears their connection was not close, though others think differently. Nobody has ever accused him of collusion, but some say their friendship, for God's sake they played on the same basketball team, a lawyer told me, might have clouded his judgment. In a hand closer to print than cursive, Lynch wrote in his journal, during breaks and the showing of interrogation videotapes, which he'd already seen, or at lunch and on weekends, filling most of every schoolboy-lined page with general observations about the law, his jurors, the death penalty, and the challenges of judgeship. On the death penalty, which he upheld, as the law required, he wrote that once the state gets into the, quote, killing business, the decisions it has to make, execute minors but not mentally retarded defendants, or the other way around, are of necessity arbitrary, and sometimes even capricious and discriminatory. In the end, he wrote, capital punishment doesn't work. He'd never kept a journal before, and isn't sure why he did, during yogurt shop. Maybe simply age, the need to reflect. There was also his longtime connection to the case. He had read about the murders on the very day he put the finishing touches on a speech announcing his candidacy for district judge. When asked if, considering that coincidence, he believed in fate, he will only say, I didn't used to. And there was its size and thrilling complexity, and the long list of rulings he'd have to make, some of which had a shot at eventually reaching the U.S. Supreme Court. If that were to happen, he'd be glad he'd written things down. If anything becomes clear from reading these pages, it's that he wasn't keeping notes just for himself. Describing the emotionally intense atmosphere that infected any death penalty case, and the stress that ran higher on both sides than during your normal robbery, rape, or even murder case, he admitted that while trying to maintain a calm, steady demeanor both on and off the bench, he'd be lying if he said he didn't feel pressure, fueled by the fear of a mistake, a gaffe, or a forgotten requirement that might jeopardize the process. This stress resulted in a compulsive need to prepare, anticipate. The need to constantly deal with the problems, real and imagined, of the trial lawyers as their intensity and animosity for each other grows as the trial nears. The difficult and time-consuming process of researching, analyzing, and producing written or oral orders on a myriad of legal issues, from simple to extremely complex. Within courthouse circles, Lynch was considered by most insiders, not all, to be fair and compassionate. He was also known for his ability to move his docket along, one of many reasons the lengthiness of Yogurt Shop especially aggravated him. Taken at face value, the Journal does much to rescue Lynch's reputation from legal and journalistic criticism. "Don't get me wrong," Carlos Garcia told me. "Lynch is a good judge. But he fucked up on Yogurt Shop, no question." Sawyer. Springsteen's lead attorney, Joe James Sawyer, was born in England and is proud of his immigrant status, his father from Mexico, his mother a Brit. He grew up in San Antonio, the eldest of four boys. After serving in Vietnam as a Green Beret paratrooper, he thought he might like either to write for the movies or to go to law school, and though the movies lost out, he still thinks about writing screenplays. When asked to describe himself, Jim Sawyer does so with a big smile, flashing his perfect teeth, arrogant, demanding, determined to win. Known as the kind of attorney who will resort to whatever courtroom theatrics he thinks might help his client, he attracted a good bit of notice when, in a shaken baby case, he banged a doll's head against the railing of the jury box to demonstrate how hard it is to dislodge a brain. Bettis, now his co-counsel, was better at preparation but less articulate on his feet and far less willing to engage in hijinks. "Burke doesn't have the ego I do," Sawyer proclaims with unabashed glee. As a courtroom performer, he's a natural. Literate, nicely tanned, he reads poetry, has a sexy burr in his voice, and a movie star smile, can quote Shakespeare, the Bible, or Thorstein Veblen at will. A female prosecutor describes him as likable in a sleazy, gangsterish kind of way. What you have to understand about Sawyer is that he knows exactly who he is and what he's up to, and how to construct a narrative and then play it out to the hilt. Self-knowledge, a visceral love for the game, and an especially keen memory partially explain his courtroom success. Plus, he's really smart, and so is his chief advisor, researcher, and passionate life partner, lawyer Deirdre Darrozet. When asked about his sources and strategy, Sawyer always gives Deirdre fulsome credit. Garcia. Carlos Garcia came late to Yogurt Shop. In early September 2001, after Springsteen had been convicted, but before Lynch could get the next trial underway, the Texas legislature approved a statute requiring that in a capital case, one of the two attorneys assigned to represent an indigent defendant must be drawn from the short list of certified capital counsel, lawyers with substantial experience in defending clients who face a possible death sentence. Through no fault of the judge, Mike Scott was represented by Tony Diaz, a civil litigator with scant criminal experience, and Dexter Guilford, an attorney who was respected and articulate, but hadn't made that list. But because his family was paying them, Scott didn't qualify as indigent, so the rule didn't apply. On the other hand, allowing Diaz to lead the defense all but guaranteed an appeal on grounds of ineffective counsel and a potential reversal. Despite objections from the prosecution, Lynch chose to honor the statute anyway. "I never understood why he did it," Carlos Garcia told me many years later. "He didn't have to." 42 at the time, a former prosecutor from a small town on the Texas-Mexico border, Garcia was so busy working on his third capital case that he hadn't paid much attention to Yogurt Shop. And he wasn't particularly interested in the job, given the stakes, the late start, and his penchant for fastidious preparation. But he was a true believer when it came to the death penalty, and like all trial lawyers, he liked the hands-on tussle of adversarial law, so he agreed to take the case if the other two men yielded the lead position to him. To give him time to catch up, Lynch postponed the next hearing for 2 months. When they were used up and Carlos asked for more time, the judge postponed again. "Not ready" will become Carlos's mantra during the entirety of Scott. A motion for a 120-day continuance, his most insistently recurring request. In his early career, Garcia had focused on the pursuit of child sexual offenders. A round man with short legs and curly, prematurely gray hair, full-blooming cheeks and sparkling eyes, he seems, and is, authentically warm and engaging, but on the job he's all out. "He may look like the Pillsbury Doughboy," a cop told me, "but Carlos can be tough. He can rile people up." When he took on Scott, he figured he'd be finished in no time. After all, his client had confessed. He'd plead him out, get a shorter sentence, and dodge the death penalty. But after he talked to Guilford, read police reports, studied evidence photos, watched the videotapes, and got hold of Johnson's PowerPoint presentation, he turned a corner. "Those boys had nothing to do with it," he says now, flipping his hand upward as if brushing an absurd idea away. "They were kids. Those girls would have laughed at them if they tried anything, even if they did have a gun." Garcia's an excellent attorney and a prodigious researcher, but if he's brought to trial before he's ready, his arguments can be diffuse and wordy. When Mike Lynch referred to Scott's lawyers as anal retentive on the law, he was mostly talking about Garcia, whose linguistic bypasses, intense attention to detail, and curlicued style of questioning explain why the trial carried on for so long. After the guilty verdict, Garcia kept working on Yogurt Shop. In 2009, after Scott's conviction had been overturned, a colleague sat in the courtroom of the 167th District Court and listened to him practice a new opening statement. "Perfect," she called it, "moving and precise, organized and finely tuned, perhaps the best she'd ever heard. Too bad nobody else got to hear it." Scott was dismissed before he had a chance to present it. The Stiletto. In contrast to both defense attorneys, the tall, lean, camera and interview-shy Robert Smith seems to have channeled the actor Jimmy Stewart as he appeared in Anatomy of a Murder, calm, quiet, low-key, with a cutthroat intelligence he keeps under wraps, preferring to come across as your everyday ordinary citizen, just like the jurors he's addressing. In truth, insiders call him the Stiletto for his ability to anticipate defensive moves and quietly slice them to shreds. Outside the courtroom, he's a different guy entirely. A man of contradictory pleasures, he likes to skydive from airplanes in his spare time, doing cartwheels in the air at 180 miles an hour, There's also an unverified rumor that he has sometimes engaged in parkour, the practice of jumping from high places in free fall to the ground, using momentum and the redistribution of body weight to perform impossible body maneuvers and land unharmed. It's hard to know which version of Smith is authentic, especially when one defense lawyer describes him as emotional, while a female colleague sums him up as hypocritical and delusional. "Wears sunglasses all the time," she snaps. "Struts around as if women were falling over all around him." Mike Lynch calls his trial work lethal. His partner in both yogurt shop trials, Darla Davis, will be his favorite death penalty teammate, the tall and attractive, dark-haired, sharp-tongued woman whom detractors call simply the Darla. Together they are fierce. A third ADA, Efren de la Fuente, will soon join them. When both cases are reversed, he will be the only one of the three to stay on. From January through March of 2000, the lawyers continued to prepare. Trial dates will soon be set for Springsteen and Scott. Awaiting his turn, Pierce would spend the next 3 years in the county jail, despite his constitutional right to a speedy trial. Wellborn kept busy at his shop. Disappointment dogs us, however adamantly we demand answers. When a jury comes in with a guilty verdict, all we really know is that's how 12 people voted. As for not guilty, this might mean a lack of evidence, or simply, as the British put it, not proven. But for the families of murdered children, ambivalence is unacceptable. Once a guilty verdict has been reached, they inevitably speak of their relief, not just because a painful process has ended, but also because the truth has been discovered, the perpetrator identified, and justice finally served. Trials matter, of course. Studying them gives us a better sense not necessarily of what happened, but of what various intelligent, determined, passionate and committed men and women made of whatever evidence and relevant speculation they'd come up with. They don't, however, always provide what we really want. Yogurt shop jurors did their job. So did the lawyers and the judge. But in the end, nobody was satisfied with how things turned out. Nobody at all. Pre-trial. Pre-trial is discovery time, when prosecutors and defense counsel exchange information and the judge decides which evidence he'll allow to come before the jury and which he'll exclude. Since it sets the stage for what's to come, in many ways it's the most important part of a criminal trial. Because everything's on the line, strategy, tactics, overriding arguments, and narrative line, the attorneys go for broke. To gain admittance of whatever evidence the police have gathered, a prosecutor will overload his stash to maximize his percentage and use any tricks he can think of to win the judge's approval. Mike Lynch says he usually allows about half of the state's grisly photographs into a murder trial. On their end, defense lawyers request witness lists, exculpatory material, raw evidence, and money to call in expert witnesses. Perhaps most important, they file motions to suppress at least some of the state's evidence, and even, if for no other reason than to get the request on the record, the case itself. Between March 30th, 2000, and January 11th, 2001, 13 yogurt shop pretrials were held jointly, with all three indicted defendants and their counsel present. Within days of the first one, at least 5 issues of dispute had been established. The defense's access to evidentiary materials, forensics including DNA testing, crime scene processing and ballistics, the admission of confessions, alleged police and prosecutorial misconduct, the scientific analysis of fire. Rancorous arguments, squabbles Lynch will call them, will continue long after two of the defendants have been convicted and carted off to prison. Most remain unresolved. The first major obstacle had to do with the matter of the file boxes. When Guillermo Gonzalez reminded the court that Judge Muirer had ruled that all documents should be copied for discovery use by each defense team, Lynch seemed to agree, until prosecutor Darla Davis informed him that the boxes contained some 55,000 pages of records, of which, by the state's estimate, only 12,000 were the Brady material, potentially exculpatory, they were required to hand over. Everything else was their case in chief, the story they planned to sell to the jury, and not to be shared. Even the lower number gave Lynch pause, and he postponed his decision. Springsteen's attorneys then filed a motion to suppress the state's only real evidence against their client, the audio and videotapes of the extended conversation conducted by APD officers within the bowels of the police department in Charleston, West Virginia. In his motion, Sawyer cited underhandedness and lies, the poor quality of the audio tape, and the actions of both Charleston and Austin police to deliberately thwart the attempts by Springsteen's attorney to meet with him and advise him of his rights. David Bungard, the lawyer, and Eric Hodges, the policeman, were flown in from Charleston, the latter to testify that he'd said Rob had been given a Miranda warning when he hadn't, the former to describe his travails in the police station. The prosecution did score a point on cross-examination when Bungard was forced to admit he didn't know about the 1966 U.S. Supreme Court ruling that police weren't constitutionally required to inform a suspect that his lawyer was trying to see him. Citing the Texas Code of Criminal Procedures, which states that confessions should be freely and voluntarily made without compulsion or persuasion, and without the respondent's will having become overborne, Mike Scott's attorneys also filed a motion to suppress all statements made by their client, written, recorded, or otherwise presented. Once he's on the case in January 2001, Garcia will cite lies, coercion, improprieties, misuse of the Reed technique, and wanton disregard for the truth. He will also display a prescription for baclofen, a drug Mike was taking for back pain, which might have weakened his ability to effectively defend himself from their grilling. Neither Sawyer nor Garcia expected their clients to be cut loose. They made these requests only to place them on the record as grounds for a future appeal and possibly outright dismissal. Judges get cranky when that happens, but lawyers do it anyway. They have to. As Sawyer explained, part of his job was to remember that this record may be reviewed someday beyond the scope and time of a jury trial. Gonzalez also asked for dismissal of the case against Maurice Pierce, citing a total lack of admissible evidence, an argument he would eventually win. Lynch postponed these decisions as well, knowing that once he allowed Springsteen's and Scott's statements into their own trials, their attorneys would then ask for suppression of accusatory testimony by any non-testifying co-defendant, no matter how it had been recorded, whether on videotape, on audio tape, or by transcription, a far trickier matter. To avoid hearsay allegations from a non-testifying witness, the Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution guarantees its citizens the right to confront, cross-examine, an accuser in court. In a 1999 ruling, Lilly v. Virginia, the Supreme Court showed its preference for a strict interpretation of this clause by ruling in favor of the petitioner, whose brother's incriminating statement to the police had been read at his trial. The vote wasn't unanimous, but the powerhouse justice, Antonin Scalia, who'd turned this issue into a pet cause from which he would never back down, marshaled his troops and snagged the victory. But lead prosecutor Smith had come up with a risky strategy that, if allowed, would enable him and his team to skirt the ruling. If they edited a co-defendant's statement so it corroborated the defendant's confession without accusing him of anything, couldn't the jury then compare the two versions and determine on its own whether there were enough points of similarity to warrant a conviction? To accomplish this, they would omit, redact, in legal terminology, the defendant's name and all significant pronouns from the statement. Again, Lynch postponed his decision. Next up, murder weapons. As would soon become apparent, since early 1999, Paul Johnson had subjected Maurice Pierce's gun to ballistics testing at least three times, once that January, then in early November, and again in May 2000. While DPS test results deemed the projectiles too damaged to be compared, ATF agents offered a more conclusive report. When fired into a telephone book, the bullets from Pierce's pistol retained impressions distinctly different from those recovered from the girls' bodies. In other words, this .22 was almost certainly not the murder weapon. Because of the difficulty of correctly analyzing the spiral grooves inside the barrel of a particular gun, almost certainly not is the most positive statement a ballistics expert will make. Other weaponry gurus would simply say it just ain't the right gun. After Johnson acknowledged his mistake in failing to inform the DA's office of the most recent tests, Gonzalez went before Lynch to demand bail reduction for Maurice Pierce on the grounds that when Muir set his bail, she didn't know about those tests. Further, in his closing statement, Buddy Meyer had unconditionally claimed evidence had proved that Maurice's gun was used on the girls. When asked on cross-examination why he hadn't shared the test results with the DA, Johnson again admitted his mistake and said he guessed he somehow forgot to mention it. "Forgot?" Gonzalez repeated. But wasn't he known as an especially meticulous investigator? "Honest mistake," said Buddy Meyer, stepping in. Lynch cut Pierce's bail by less than 10% to $700,000. The next day, on May 11, 2000, a local television station cited the DPS and ATF ballistics reports on its 6 o'clock and late night broadcasts. 3 days later, the same story ran in the Statesman with a direct quote from the federal agent who'd conducted the tests. How did the press get the information? Obviously, the prosecution hotly charged, Lynch's gag order had been violated, and they promptly studied how to turn this allegation to their advantage. Meanwhile, to draw attention from Johnson's gaffe, the DA's office asked for and received permission from the city to hire, at taxpayers' expense, speedboats equipped with side-scan sonar so the DPS dive recovery team could search under the Loop 360 bridge over Lake Austin for the missing second gun, which Mike Scott thought Rob Springsteen might have tossed into a lake from one high bridge or another. Of course, Mike thought the gun was a .38, not a .380. And even if somebody definitively identified which bridge, the chance of actually finding the weapon ran from slim to none. During the 1991 Christmas flood, five sluices had been opened three times a day, moving enough silty water through Lake Austin to make it flow like the Mississippi. Since then, five more storms had flushed it out as well. After hauling up bed frames, grocery carts, shoes, and car parts, the boats were trailered back to Florida where they'd come from, and all ballistics reports were handed over to the defense. Those lawyers also requested recordings or transcripts of all other yogurt shop confessions, as well as audio tapes of their clients' jailhouse conversations. For this, they needed money for an investigator and for expert witnesses on fire, false confessions, and memory, not to mention a ballistics guy and a crime scene reconstructor. They wanted to submit the state's DNA findings to their own lab. Arguing for a change of venue, Mike Scott's attorneys exhibited the video clip of Robert Merrill holding the muzzle of a gun to the back of their client's head. This request was denied, but the next day the Statesman ran a story headlined, "Video Could Damage Yogurt Shop Case." By the middle of May, Texans had begun steeling themselves for a blistering summer, yet for most of the state, June was unusually cool, and a cold front had brought 5 inches of rain, which made for a bountiful crop of tomatoes and peaches. By then, the prosecution had figured out how to benefit from the ballistics fiasco. "You," a steaming Darla Davis told Lynch on May 21st, "put us on our honor not to disclose information to reporters or anybody else." But the defense, she claimed, had clearly ignored his order and leaked the non-results to the TV station and the newspaper. And since there was no way of knowing which lawyers were responsible, they all should pay. The state then requested limited access to the 33 boxes and no Xeroxing. The files should remain in the DA's office. Defense attorneys or their officially registered representatives could ask for a particular box and then sit and take notes, page by page. There were carrels in the lobby of the office where they could work, so what was wrong with that? Lynch doesn't like to talk about loneliness on the bench. There's no use in it. Occasionally, after handing down a ruling, he'll lean forward and ask, "Anything else you want me to decide?" Access to the boxes was a big one. After a long pause, he told Davis he'd issue his decision soon. The prosecution lurched ahead. Paul Johnson ordered another test of Maurice Pierce's gun, with the same results. The DPS issued a lab report concluding once again that no DNA left at the crime scene matched any of these 4 men. When the grand jury finally and definitively refused to indict him, Forrest Wellborn was freed of all charges. One of those jurors, Diana Castaneda, requested a meeting with Lynch to talk about the conduct of the DA's office, especially during the yogurt shop proceedings. They were stingy with evidence, she claimed, and didn't provide the items they'd asked for. There was a rush to judgment. After thanking her, the judge ushered her from his chambers. In late August, Lynch issued his ruling on Sawyer's motion to suppress Springsteen's videotaped confession. Denied. He saw no evidence of coercion, given that the defendant had gone willingly to the Charleston Police Department's offices and remained there after being given several opportunities to leave. As for his interrogator's duplicity, the Supreme Court had sanctioned the use of reasonable deception to pry the truth from a suspect and had also ruled that police officers were not legally bound to allow a lawyer hired by a third party access to the suspect, even if the third party was family, decisions that the Statesman called major victories for the prosecution after many setbacks. Lynch would issue the same ruling during Scott, citing the suspect's willingness to travel to the police station day after day, as well as his lack of interest in hiring an attorney. Unquestionably, the prosecution was scoring points, but those gains didn't mean much if they couldn't nail Pierce. Ronnie Earle visited the other 3 defense teams to offer a deal to any co-defendant who would testify against him, but the young men all said pretty much the same thing. They wouldn't admit to doing something they didn't do, and furthermore had no intention of implicating a friend. Wellborn, when asked if he'd considered confessing to get the cops off his back, "No, I'd never lie about something like that." Springsteen, "I got myself into this mess. I'll have to get myself out." Scott, "How stupid do they think I am, not to take a deal if it was true?" Garcia. We told them, look, there's no deal on the table. Near the end of October, more than a year after the arrests, Lynch issued his decision on those 33 boxes and once again sided with the prosecution. No Xeroxing. He had arranged to pay a maximum of $7,200 a month, $20 an hour for up to 360 hours, for representatives of all three defense teams to sit in the DA's office and make notes by hand. Once the two sides started bickering about details, Lynch asked a member of the sheriff's department to lock them all in a room until they hashed out a workable plan. After several hours, they emerged with a schedule of discovery that was mutually acceptable. But the defense had lost a big one. Attorney Alexandra Gauthier would soon begin her long relationship with Yogurt Shop as a researcher and intern. She would spend many hours in a cramped carrel in the DA's lobby, sitting in a stiff chair, going through material line by line and page by page, copying quotes, reports, and diagrams. Before long, she'd develop carpal tunnel syndrome, her wrists simply worn out. In November, Ronnie Earle was reelected to his seventh term as Travis County DA, despite an unusual all-out Republican push, including billboards showing a mock Monopoly board with his face on a get-out-of-jail-free card. As the year ended, the coldest weather in years swept the state. Sleet, rain, and even a little snow made for a dark and forbidding Christmas. Every year, Barbara Ayers Wilson buys artificial poinsettias to put on the girls' graves. She takes rags and a spray bottle of liquid cleanser to shine up the stones and the bench behind them. As 2000 neared its end, she and the other parents felt cautiously hopeful, even about Forrest. Surely the APD and the DA's office would figure out how to bring him back in. Fire. While lawyers split hairs, Paul Johnson kept busy trying to solve some nagging problems, starting with the discrepancy between Mike Scott's description of how the fire started, those cups and napkins thrown on the girls' bodies, sprayed with lighter fluid and lit with a Zippo, and the general agreement among arson experts that no accelerant had been used and that the fire had been set by igniting combustibles stored on the stainless steel shelves. Once again, he called on Marshall Littleton, but his old friend still declined to get involved. In the first place, he didn't feel altogether qualified. There were more experienced BATF experts in D.C. In addition, the modeling software didn't work in every situation. You fed the program with specifics, burn marks, size of room, height of ceiling, presence of windows or doors, heat of flames, duration and patterns of fire, whatever input you had, and it came up with what it considered appropriate data concerning the origin and cause. But if the model contradicted the prosecution's position, then where would they be? When Johnson insisted that his help was essential, Littleton soon relented, and after a few tries found a model that worked. Johnson then called Melvin Stahl and asked him to meet with them. Initially, Stahl wouldn't budge from his original analysis, but after hearing Littleton out, he either changed his mind or simply agreed to go along. In court, he would testify that after recently examining the crime scene photos for the first time, even though he'd taken most of them, he'd decided he'd been wrong. Clearly, he said, the fire had originated not on the shelves, as he'd once thought, but on the girls' bodies, as Mike Scott had claimed. Nobody can say who persuaded Stahl to reverse himself, though the most likely candidates are Paul Johnson and Robert Smith. Most favor the cop. At any rate, this solved the DA's fire problem. Even Barbara Ayers Wilson, who knew Stahl, felt bad for him. His testimony from the witness box, she said, destroyed him. You could see his face crumbling. jury selection. Springsteen. Lynch's plan was to call 300 panelists from which to select a jury. Yet on this issue, both prosecution and defense agreed. The case was so notorious locally that they wanted him to call twice that many. Lynch concurred but made a bet with the lawyers that his estimate would suffice. After saying he hated to take the judge's money, Bettis shook on it, and eventually had to pay up. To each group of panelists, Lynch made a general statement explaining reasonable doubt, the Fifth Amendment, our adversarial judicial system, and the rules governing issuance of the death penalty. Then, after both sides made their opening remarks, each took turns conducting interviews. Among those in the courtroom that day, April 16, 2001, was Springsteen's wife, Robin, who told the Statesman her husband felt isolated in jail and had gained weight. He was, she said, gentle and good, and had confessed only because he'd been drinking the night before and hadn't slept. But she didn't stick around for the trial. After a day or so, she went back to West Virginia, never to return, Sawyer says because Rob didn't want his family to make the trip. Within 15 days, after some 200-odd panelists had been screened, a jury of 7 men, including 2 alternates, and 7 women had been seated. Ranging in age from late teens to middle age, 2 were African American, 3 were Latino, the rest white. Afterward, in Lynch's chambers, Sawyer again pressed him to allow other yogurt shop confessions into evidence, especially since many of them offered accurate details about the crime scene, including APD holdback evidence, and the judge grudgingly promised to come up with a decision soon. But he warned Sawyer that every Tom, Dick, and Harry who'd seen little green men at the yogurt shop would not be filing into his courtroom. Sawyer agreed. No little green men. The next day, Springsteen moved into its final pretrial phase. Called in limine, or at the threshold, it offers attorneys a final opportunity to present motions. Once again, the defense argued for suppression of Mike Scott's statement on the twofold grounds of hearsay and Sixth Amendment guarantees, though Lynch refused to rule on it until he'd heard the evidence and arguments after context had been established. In postponing, the judge hampered both sides' ability to create a case, especially the defense's. But since this would be one of the biggest decisions of his career, and because he had the right to wait, he did. On May 8, 2001, before a packed courtroom, Lynch swore in the Springsteen jury and issued his standard instructions. Jurors were not to talk to anybody about anything that happened in the courtroom or to mingle with people connected to yogurt shop. They shouldn't consult articles about it or read up on any laws or rules they didn't understand. Until they were discharged, everything they knew about this case should come solely from evidence presented in the courtroom. He also banned note-taking in the jury box. Scott. 14 months later, on the day voir dire was set to begin in the second yogurt shop trial, Dexter Gilford filed an objection. The racial array of the panel, he charged, did not represent a fair cross-section of the community as the law required. Mike Scott, of course, is white, but his defense team comprised 2 Mexican-Americans, Garcia and Diaz, and 1 African-American, Gilford, and this might have encouraged them to argue the point. More than likely, however, they were simply stalling for time, and when Lynch found no basis for the complaint, the defense dropped the objection, and 2.5 weeks later, on August 8, 2002, a jury was seated, 9 women and 5 men, 2 of them alternates. In his journal, Lynch called the Scott jury perhaps the most intelligent he'd ever had in his courtroom. But Tony Diaz's unproductive tenure as Scott's lead attorney had forced Garcia and Guilford to start from scratch. So they had to scramble by working together every night and well into the morning, and the toll on their personal lives included health and marital issues. When Lynch denied their motion to suppress a summarized printout of Springsteen's videotaped statement, defense and prosecution cooperated to create a mutually acceptable redaction. By then, Garcia had uttered the words, "not ready," at least 9 times. And when the judge asked if anyone objected to a day's postponement, Guilford weighed in as well to say their only concern was that it came up short by 119 days. When he talks about Yogurt Shop today, Garcia still gets angry. "I hate this fucking case," he'll growl. "I hate talking about it." I don't think his anger will ever diminish. For one reason, because he feels he and the other two lawyers did no better than an adequate job for Mike Scott. And for another, if there had been a retrial, he thinks they could have gotten him off. But mostly his anger stems from his unflinching belief that in order to win the case, the DA's office, especially Robert Smith, threw justice out the window. In the courtroom, frustration sometimes got the best of him. During one of Scott's final pretrials, when he requested transcripts of the grand jury hearings, and Lynch turned snarky, lecturing him on protocol, Garcia's response was equally caustic and imprudent. "This is your courtroom, and you know what you're doing." To which the judge replied, "There's been some doubt cast on that today." And when Garcia made yet another motion for continuance, Lynch grew even more impatient. "This case," he curtly explained, as if to an outsider, "was indicted December of 1999. Shortly thereafter, we started joint pretrial hearings. We have covered squabbles that sounded more like a bunch of chickens in a chicken yard than it did lawyers in a courtroom, arguing back and forth. We've had 3 lawyers now on the case, some combination thereof, or 4 if you count the discovery lawyer, for over 2 years. There comes a time when you just have to try the case." Garcia countered with a request for a standing motion for continuance to run through the entire trial. And after Lynch's instructions to the jury, Garcia objected to the note-taking ban, which necessitated yet another lengthy explanation from the judge. Higher courts had ruled that jurors' written notes must be collected by the bailiff before every break and at the end of each day, and could not be shared among themselves or used during final deliberations. As Lynch saw it, note-taking didn't fulfill its intended purpose, so the jury should instead listen carefully, take mental notes, and remember what had happened and what they thought about it. But by then, Garcia had come up with another reason for delay: mistrial, or even better, dismissal. Jury trials. Springsteen. An opening statement, Lynch explained to the jury, was opinion, not evidence. It represented a kind of table of contents for what each side thought the evidence would show. Jurors should remember that the system was adversarial, one story versus another, and he asked the defendant to rise so the trial could commence. Asked to read the indictment, Smith stood. The case against the defendant was based on the grand jury's opinion that, on or about the 6th day of December 1991, Robert Springsteen IV did intentionally cause the death of an individual, namely Amy Ayers, by shooting her with a firearm, a deadly weapon, and by strangling her with a ligature, a deadly weapon, while in the course of committing or attempting to commit the offense of burglary, against the peace and dignity of the state. And how did the defendant plead? "Not guilty, Your Honor." Lynch again spoke to the jury. Because the state bore the burden of proving every element of its case beyond a reasonable doubt, it had both the right and the duty to speak first. The stiletto rose once more to continue. On Friday night, December 6, 1991, two high school senior girls were working at the I Can't Believe It's Yogurt shop on West Anderson Lane, here in Austin, Travis County, Texas. That Friday night, it was scheduled to be closed by Jennifer Harbison and Eliza Thomas. They worked there after school, and they were supposed to close that shop that night at 11 o'clock. Prosecutors don't beat around the bush. They present their story without maybes or perhapses. After placing Eliza, Jennifer, Sarah, and Amy at the ICBY shop, Smith then piled Springsteen, Pierce, Scott, and Wellborn in Pierce's car, first to assess the prospects at the shop, and later that night, after it had closed, to enter it through the back door for the purpose of robbing it. Because the DA had asked for a death sentence, this was important. According to the Texas Penal Code, a capital crime is one in which an act of intentional murder has been committed in the course of other felonies, including sexual assault and robbery. Smith described the boys' surprise at finding four girls in the shop instead of two, then moved on to the crime itself. "The evidence will show you, ladies and gentlemen, that these four girls were herded to the back of the shop and they were robbed at gunpoint. And in the small, small confines of that back room, they were forced to take off all their clothes. Then they were bound with their hands behind their backs, and then they were gagged with their own socks. And three of these girls, Sarah, Jennifer, and Eliza, were killed. Shot execution style, contact wound to the back of the head with a .22 caliber revolver." He then went on to describe the struggles and murder of Amy Ayers. After about an hour of this, he ended with a boilerplate prediction. "There is going to be no question, when you hear all of this evidence, that you are sitting in the courtroom with the man that killed Amy Ayers." If Springsteen's lawyers were clear about anything, it was that if they were to elicit any sympathy at all for their client, they had to underscore their unqualified sympathy for the families of the murdered girls. And so Sawyer's opening also led off with the girls. "Your Honor, may it please the court, counsel, I will not say good morning to you. That would be obscene. There is nothing good about mourning when we begin the process of discussing the deaths of four young girls in the presence of the family and loved ones. And maybe the only thing to say in regard to that is," quoting the New Testament, "sufficient unto the day is the evil of the day." He then addressed the overriding question from the defense point of view. What went wrong? How is it that Robert Springsteen sits here having confessed to crimes that I believe he did not commit? He criticized the lack of protocol and accepted standards in the preservation of the crime scene, spent a long time talking about the importance of fire as evidence, and finished up with a flourish, telling the jury that in the end he could offer only one absolute regarding this case, which was that there is not one shred of physical evidence to connect Mr. Springsteen to the commission of this crime, and there was not before he was interviewed. "We have to let the evidence tell the story," he insisted, "not tell the evidence what happened." Sawyer didn't use notes, and he didn't put on his reading glasses. He, too, spoke for about an hour. The state opened its case by calling Bob Ayers, who described his daughter, her cowgirl dreams, and FFA activities, and provided details of her plans for the evening of December 6th. He recalled the last moment he and his wife saw her alive, and confirmed that the photograph Smith showed him was indeed of Amy. Smith handed it to the jurors, who passed it around. He then asked what Amy was wearing that night, what kind of underpants, jeans, boots, and jacket. "And what about the heart-shaped buckle from the missing belt? And did Ayers recognize the Jiminy Cricket tote bag? When Smith passed his witness, Sawyer declined the opportunity to cross-examine. He would ask no questions of the girls' families. The prosecution was following standard procedure in a murder case, establishing chronology and humanizing the victims. When Barbara Ayers Wilson was called to the stand by Darla Davis, she spoke of her daughter's love of animals, sports, and country music, then described her after-school meeting with Sarah, Jennifer's arrival, the call to Amy, and the two sisters heading off together in the S-10. Davis then presented photographs, Jennifer in her graduation gown, smiling radiantly, Sarah in a sweater, a cross around her neck, shrimp earrings, those big, wide-set, skeptical eyes. Maria Thomas, in turn, described Eliza's love for her pig and her beat-up green VW, their visit to the barn, and hers to the yogurt shop that night. The photograph Davis showed the jury was of a lustrous, smiling Eliza in a friend's Texas A&M dorm room, wearing a fuzzy white sweater, her dark hair falling in deep swirls around her face. Smith then returned to question James Thomas, after which De La Fuente questioned the Harbison girls' boyfriends, Sammy Buchanan and Mike McCathern, as well as former security guard Darrell Croft. Prompted by Davis, Lucella Jones told the court that, in the APD's photo lineup, Maurice Pierce most resembled the scary young man she'd seen that night. And so, before moving to the closing of the shop and the discovery of the bodies, the prosecutor set the stage, establishing the innocent, hopeful nature of the four girls and their activities, before turning to the crime itself, beginning with the testimony of Troy Gay, who explained DWI patrols, and then how he had driven toward Anderson Lane and seen the smoke, then the flames, then Jorge Barney, and then called the fire department. Urged on by Smith's quiet questions, he covered his every move and thought, eventually arriving at the moment when a firefighter came outside and said there were naked dead girls lying inside, in the muck. When Robert Smith asked for permission to project color photos of the crime scene onto a large video screen, he apologized for the graphic horror of what jurors and spectators were about to see. As Sawyer says, it was time to wave the bloody flag. When asked which girl they had seen first, Gay replied, "The one body that was by itself, Amy Ayers." And as Smith projected photos of Amy, head resting on the flowered blouse, right arm torqued oddly under her body, as if she were reaching beyond her left shoulder, head turned, chin almost resting on her upper arm, then a close-up of her face, Gay pointed out the cash drawer, the loose coins, her swollen bottom lip, the exit wound in her cheek, the red marks on her neck. One juror crossed her arms over her chest as if in protection. The girls' families dropped their heads and sobbed. Barbara Ayers Wilson, who had gone to the DA's office before the trial to study the photos, had told the other parents and grandparents to look down and close their eyes. Just don't look. The state called firefighter Rene Hector Garza, who recreated how the AFD had entered, sprayed some 500 gallons of water on the flames, and discovered first Amy's body, then those of the others. The last photos Garza identified were of the shop's front door with the cardboard sign in the window flipped to closed, and pictures of the service area taken from the front doorway, the upside-down chairs, clean tables, everything still neat and carefully tended, despite the smoke and the chaos. During cross, Sawyer asked Gay and then Garza if by chance they'd moved the bodies, even accidentally. They couldn't answer absolutely, of course, but didn't think so. When Garza's testimony ended and Lynch called for an early recess, nobody minded. Efren de la Fuente was the prosecution's fire expert, and by noon the next